A really happy man says little and laughs little, he hugs his happiness, so to speak, to his heart. Noisy games, violent delight, conceal the disappointment of satiety. But melancholy is the friend of pleasure, tears and pity attend our sweetest enjoyment, and great joys call for tears rather than laughter. If at first the number and variety of our amusements seem to contribute to our happiness, if at first the even tenor of a quiet life seems tedious, when we look at it more closely we discover that the pleasantest habit of mind consists in a moderate enjoyment which leaves little scope for desire and aversion. The unrest of passion causes curiosity and fickleness, the emptiness of noisy pleasures causes weariness. We never weary of our state when we know none more delightful. Savages suffer less than other men from curiosity and from tedium, everything is the same to them themselves, not their possessions, and they are never weary. The man of the world almost always wears a mask. He is scarcely ever himself and is almost a stranger to himself, he is ill at ease when he is forced into his own company. Not what he is, but what he seems, is all he cares for. I cannot help picturing in the countenance of the young man I have just spoken of an indefinable but unpleasant impertinence, smoothness, and affectation, which is repulsive to a plain man, and in the countenance of my own pupil a simple and interesting expression which indicates the real contentment and the calm of his mind. An expression which inspires respect and confidence, and seems only to await the establishment of friendly relations to bestow his own confidence in return. It is thought that the expression is merely the development of certain features designed by nature. For my own part, one think that over and above this development a man's face is shaped, all unconsciously, by the frequent and habitual influence of certain affections of the heart. These affections are shown on the face, there is nothing more certain, and when they become habitual, they must surely leave lasting traces. This is why I think the expression shows the character, and that we can sometimes read one another without seeking mysterious explanations in powers we do not possess. A child has only two distinct feelings, joy and sorrow, he laughs or he cries, he knows no middle course, and he is constantly passing from one extreme to the other. On account of these perpetual changes there is no lasting impression on the face, and no expression, but when the child is older and more sensitive, his feelings are keener or more permanent, and these deeper impressions leave traces more difficult to erase, and the habitual state of the feelings has an effect on the features which in course of time becomes ineffaceable. Still, it is not uncommon to meet with men whose expression varies with their age. I have met with several, and I have always found that those whom I could observe and follow had also changed their habitual temper. This one observation thoroughly confirmed would seem to me decisive, and it is not out of place in a treatise on education, where it is a matter of importance, that we should learn to judge the feelings of the heart by external signs. I do not know whether my young man will be any the less amiable for not having learned to copy conventional manners and to feign sentiments which are not his own. That does not concern me at present, I only know he will be more affectionate, and I find it difficult to believe that he, who cares for nobody but himself, can so far disguise his true feelings as to please as readily as he who finds fresh happiness for himself in his affection for others. But with regard to this feeling of happiness, I think I have said enough already for the guidance of any sensible reader, and to show that I have not contradicted myself. I return to my system, and I say, when the critical age approaches, present to young people spectacles which restrain rather than excite them, put off their dawning imagination with objects which, far from inflaming their senses, put a check to their activity. Remove them from great cities, where the flaunting attire and the boldness of the women hasten and anticipate the teaching of nature, where everything presents to their view pleasures of which they should know nothing till they are of an age to choose for themselves. Bring them back to their early home, where rural simplicity allows the passions of their age to develop more slowly, or if their taste for the arts keeps them in town, guard them by means of this very taste from a dangerous idleness. Choose carefully their company, their occupations, and their pleasures, show them nothing but modest and pathetic pictures which are touching but not seductive, and nourish their sensibility without stimulating their senses. Remember also, that the danger of excess is not confined to any one place, and that immoderate passions always do irreparable damage. You need not make your pupil a sick nurse or a brother of pity, you need not distress him by the perpetual sight of pain and suffering, you need not take him from one hospital to another, from the gallows to the prison. He must be softened, not hardened, by the sight of human misery. When we have seen a sight, it ceases to impress us, uses second nature, what is always before our eyes no longer appeals to the imagination, and it is only through the imagination that we can feel the sorrows of others. This is why priests and doctors who are always beholding death and suffering become so hardened. Let your pupil therefore know something of the lot of man and the woes of his fellow creatures, but let him not see them too often. A single thing, carefully selected and shown at the right time, will fill him with pity and set him thinking for a month. His opinion about anything depends not so much on what he sees, but on how it reacts on himself, and his lasting impression of any object depends less on the object itself than on the point of view from which he regards it. Thus, by a sparing use of examples, lessons, and pictures, you may blunt the sting of sense and delay nature while following her own lead. As he acquires knowledge, choose what ideas he shall attach to it; as his passions awake, select scenes calculated to repress them. A veteran, as distinguished for his character as for his courage, once told me that in early youth his father, a sensible man but extremely pious, observed that through his growing sensibility he was attracted by women, and spared no pains to restrain him. But at last, when, in spite of all his care, his son was about to escape from his control, he decided to take him to a hospital. And, without telling him what to expect, he introduced him into a room where a number of wretched creatures were expiating, under a terrible treatment, the vices which had brought them into this plight. This hideous and revolting spectacle sickened the young man. "Miserable libertine," said his father vehemently, "begone, follow your vile tastes; you will soon be only too glad to be admitted to this ward, and a victim to the most shameful sufferings; you will compel your father to thank God when you are dead." These few words, together with the striking spectacle he beheld, made an impression on the young man which could never be effaced. Compelled by his profession to pass his youth in garrison, he preferred to face all the jests of his comrades rather than to share their evil ways. "I have been a man," he said to me, "I have had my weaknesses, but even to the present day the sight of a harlot inspires me with horror." Say little to your pupil, but choose time, place, and people. Then rely on concrete examples for your teaching, and be sure it will take effect. The way childhood is spent is no great matter; the evil which may find its way is not irremediable, and the good which may spring up might come later. But it is not so in those early years when a youth really begins to live. This time is never long enough for what there is to be done, and its importance demands unceasing attention. This is why I lay so much stress on the art of prolonging it. One of the best rules of good farming is to keep things back as much as possible. Let your progress also be slow and sure; prevent the youth from becoming a man all at once. While the body is growing, the spirits destined to give vigor to the blood and strength to the muscles are in process of formation and elaboration. If you turn them into another channel, and permit that strength which should have gone to the perfecting of one person to go to the making of another, both remain in a state of weakness and the work of nature is unfinished. The workings of the mind, in their turn, are affected by this change, and the mind, as sickly as the body, functions languidly and feebly. Length and strength of limb are not the same thing as courage or genius, and I grant that strength of mind does not always accompany strength of body, when the means of connection between the two are otherwise faulty. But however well planned they may be, they will always work feebly if for motive power they depend upon an exhausted, impoverished supply of blood, deprived of the substance which gives strength and elasticity to all the springs of the machinery. There is generally more vigor of mind to be found among men whose early years have been preserved from precocious vice than among those whose evil living has begun at the earliest opportunity, and this is no doubt the reason why nations whose morals are pure are generally superior in sense and courage to those whose morals are bad. The latter shine only through I know not what small and trifling qualities, which they call wit, sagacity, cunning, but those great and noble features of goodness and reason, by which a man is distinguished and honored through good deeds, virtues, really useful efforts, are scarcely to be found except among the nations whose morals are pure. Teachers complain that the energy of this age makes their pupils unruly. I see that it is so, but are not they themselves to blame? When once they have let this energy flow through the channel of the senses, do they not know that they cannot change its course? Will the long and dreary sermons of the pedant efface from the mind of his scholar the thoughts of pleasure when once they have found an entrance? Will they banish from his heart the desires by which it is tormented? Will they chill the heat of a passion whose meaning the scholar realizes? Will not the pupil be roused to anger by the obstacles opposed to the only kind of happiness of which he has any notion? And in the harsh law imposed upon him before he can understand it, what will he see but the caprice and hatred of a man who is trying to torment him? Is it strange that he rebels and hates you too? I know very well that if one is easygoing, one may be tolerated, and one may keep up a show of authority. But I fail to see the use of an authority over the pupil which is only maintained by fomenting the vices it ought to repress. It is like attempting to soothe a fiery steed by making it leap over a precipice. Far from being a hindrance to education, this enthusiasm of adolescence is its crown and coping stone. This it is that gives you a hold on the youth's heart when he is no longer weaker than you. His first affections are the reins by which you control his movements. He was free, and now I behold him in your power. So long as he loved nothing, he was independent of everything but himself and his own necessities. As soon as he loves, he is dependent on his affections. Thus the first ties which unite him to his species are already formed. When you direct his increasing sensibility in this direction, do not expect that it will at once include all men, and that the word mankind will have any meaning for him. Not so, this sensibility will at first confine itself to those like himself, and these will not be strangers to him, but those he knows, those whom habit has made dear to him or necessary to him, those who are evidently thinking and feeling as he does, those whom he perceives to be exposed to the pains he has endured, those who enjoy the pleasures he has enjoyed, in a word, those who are so like himself that he is the more disposed to self-love. It is only after long training, after much consideration as to his own feelings and the feelings he observes in others, that he will be able to generalize his individual notions under the abstract idea of humanity, and add to his individual affections those which may identify him with the race. When he becomes capable of affection, he becomes aware of the affection of others, and he is on the lookout for the signs of that affection. Do you not see how you will acquire a fresh hold on him? What bands have you bound about his heart while he was yet unaware of them? What will he feel, when he beholds himself and sees what you have done for him, when he can compare himself with other youths, and other tutors with you? I say, when he sees it, but beware lest you tell him of it. If you tell him, he will not perceive it. If you claim his obedience in return for the care bestowed upon him, he will think you have overreached him. He will see that while you profess to have cared for him without reward, you meant to saddle him with a debt and to bind him to a bargain which he never made. In vain you will add that what you demand is for his own good. You demand it, and you demand it in virtue of what you have done without his consent. When a man down on his luck accepts the shilling which the sergeant professes to give him, and finds he has enlisted without knowing what he was about, you protest against the injustice. Is it not still more unjust to demand from your pupil the price of care which he has not even accepted? Ingratitude would be rarer if kindness were less often the investment of a usurer. We love those who have done us a kindness. What a natural feeling! Ingratitude is not to be found in the heart of man, but self-interest is there. Those who are ungrateful for benefits received are fewer than those who do a kindness for their own ends. If you sell me your gifts, I will haggle over the price, but if you pretend to give, in order to sell later on at your own price, you are guilty of fraud. It is the free gift which is beyond price. The heart is a law to itself. If you try to bind it, you lose it. Give it its liberty, and you make it your own. When the fisherman baits his line, the fish come round him without suspicion, but when they are caught on the hook concealed in the bait, they feel the line tighten and they try to escape. Is the fisherman a benefactor? Is the fish ungrateful? Do we find a man forgotten by his benefactor, unmindful of that benefactor? On the contrary, he delights to speak of him. He cannot think of him without emotion. If he gets a chance of showing him, by some unexpected service, that he remembers what he did for him, how delighted he is to satisfy his gratitude, what a pleasure it is to earn the gratitude of his benefactor. How delightful to say, "It is my turn now." This is indeed the teaching of nature. A good deed never caused ingratitude. If therefore gratitude is a natural feeling, and you do not destroy its effects by your blunders, be sure your pupil, as he begins to understand the value of your care for him, will be grateful for it, provided you have not put a price upon it, and this will give you an authority over his heart which nothing can overthrow. But beware of losing this advantage before it is really yours. Beware of insisting on your own importance. Boast of your services and they become intolerable, forget them and they will not be forgotten. Until the time comes to treat him as a man, let there be no question of his duty to you, but his duty to himself. Let him have his freedom if you would make him docile, hide yourself so that he may seek you, raise his heart to the noble sentiment of gratitude by only speaking of his own interest. Until he was able to understand, I would not have him told that what was done was for his good, he would only have understood such words to mean that you were dependent on him and he would merely have made you his servant. But now that he is beginning to feel what love is, he also knows what a tender affection may bind a man to what he loves, and in the zeal which keeps you busy on his account, he now sees not the bonds of a slave, but the affection of a friend. Now there is nothing which carries so much weight with the human heart as the voice of friendship recognized as such, for we know that it never speaks but for our good. We may think our friend is mistaken, but we never believe he is deceiving us. We may reject his advice now and then, but we never scorn it. We have reached the moral order at last, we have just taken the second step towards manhood. If this were the place for it, I would try to show how the first impulses of the heart give rise to the first stirrings of conscience, and how from the feelings of love and hatred spring the first notions of good and evil. I would show that justice and kindness are no mere abstract terms, no mere moral conceptions framed by the understanding, but true affections of the heart enlightened by reason, the natural outcome of our primitive affections, that by reason alone, unaided by conscience, we cannot establish any natural law, and that all natural right is a vain dream if it does not rest upon some instinctive need of the human heart. But I do not think it is my business at present to prepare treatises on metaphysics and morals, nor courses of study of any kind whatsoever. It is enough if I indicate the order and development of our feelings and our knowledge in relation to our growth. Others will perhaps work out what I have here merely indicated. Hitherto my Emil has thought only of himself, so his first glance at his equals leads him to compare himself with them, and the first feeling excited by this comparison is the desire to be first. It is here that self-love is transformed into selfishness, and this is the starting point of all the passions which spring from selfishness. But to determine whether the passions by which his life will be governed shall be humane and gentle or harsh and cruel, whether they shall be the passions of benevolence and pity or those of envy and covetousness, we must know what he believes his place among men to be, and what sort of obstacles he expects to have to overcome in order to attain to the position he seeks. To guide him in this inquiry, after we have shown him men by means of the accidents common to the species, we must now show him them by means of their differences. This is the time for estimating inequality natural and civil, and for the scheme of the whole social order. Society must be studied in the individual and the individual in society. Those who desire to treat politics and morals apart from one another will never understand either. By confining ourselves at first to the primitive relations, we see how men should be influenced by them and what passions should spring from them. We see that it is in proportion to the development of these passions that a man's relations with others expand or contract. It is not so much strength of arm as moderation of spirit which makes men free and independent. The man whose wants are few is dependent on but few people, but those who constantly confound our vain desires with our bodily needs, those who have made these needs the basis of human society, are continually mistaking effects for causes, and they have only confused themselves by their own reasoning. Since it is impossible in the state of nature that the difference between man and man should be great enough to make one dependent on another, there is in fact in this state of nature an actual and indestructible equality. In the civil state there is a vain and chimerical equality of right, the means intended for its maintenance, themselves serve to destroy it, and the power of the community, added to the power of the strongest for the oppression of the weak, disturbs the sort of equilibrium which nature has established between them. From this first contradiction spring all the other contradictions between the real and the apparent, which are to be found in the civil order. The many will always be sacrificed to the few, the common will to private interest. Those specious words justice and subordination will always serve as the tools of violence and the weapons of injustice, hence it follows that the higher classes which claim to be useful to the rest are really only seeking their own welfare at the expense of others. From this we may judge how much consideration is due to them according to right and justice. It remains to be seen if the rank to which they have attained is more favorable to their own happiness to know what opinion each one of us should form with regard to his own lot. This is the study with which we are now concerned, but to do it thoroughly we must begin with a knowledge of the human heart. If it were only a question of showing young people man in his mask, there would be no need to point him out, and he would always be before their eyes, but since the mask is not the man, and since they must not be led away by its specious appearance, when you paint men for your scholar, paint them as they are, not that he may hate them, but that he may pity them and have no wish to be like them. In my opinion, that is the most reasonable view a man can hold with regard to his fellow men. With this object in view, we must take the opposite way from that hitherto followed, and instruct the youth rather through the experience of others than through his own. If men deceive him, he will hate them, but if, while they treat him with respect, he sees them deceiving each other, he will pity them. The spectacle of the world, said Pythagoras, is like the Olympic Games. Some are buying and selling and think only of their gains, others take an active part and strive for glory, others, and these not the worst, are content to be lookers on. I would have you so choose the company of a youth that he should think well of those among whom he lives, and I would have you so teach him to know the world that he should think ill of all that takes place in it. Let him know that man is by nature good, let him feel it, let him judge his neighbor by himself, but let him see how men are depraved and perverted by society, let him find the source of all their vices in their preconceived opinions, let him be disposed to respect the individual, but to despise the multitude, let him see that all men wear almost the same mask, but let him also know that some faces are fairer than the mask that conceals them. It must be admitted that this method has its drawbacks, and it is not easy to carry it out, for if he becomes too soon engrossed in watching other people, if you train him to mark too closely the actions of others, you will make him spiteful and satirical, quick and decided in his judgments of others, he will find a hateful pleasure in seeking bad motives, and will fail to see the good even in that which is really good. He will, at least, get used to the sight of vice, he will behold the wicked without horror, just as we get used to seeing the wretched without pity. Soon the perversity of mankind will be not so much a warning as an excuse, he will say, man is made so, and he will have no wish to be different from the rest. But if you wish to teach him theoretically to make him acquainted, not only with the heart of man, but also with the application of the external causes which turn our inclinations into vices. When you thus transport him all at once from the objects of sense to the objects of reason, you employ a system of metaphysics which he is not in a position to understand. You fall back into the error, so carefully avoided hitherto, of giving him lessons which are like lessons, of substituting in his mind the experience and the authority of the master for his own experience and the development of his own reason. To remove these two obstacles at once, and to bring the human heart within his reach without risk of spoiling his own, I would show him men from afar, in other times or in other places, so that he may behold the scene but cannot take part in it. This is the time for history. With its help he will read the hearts of men without any lessons in philosophy, with its help he will view them as a mere spectator, dispassionate and without prejudice, he will view them as their judge, not as their accomplice or their accuser. To know men you must behold their actions. In society we hear them talk, they show their words and hide their deeds, but in history the veil is drawn aside, and they are judged by their deeds. Their sayings even help us to understand them, for comparing what they say and what they do, we see not only what they are but what they would appear. The more they disguise themselves, the more thoroughly they stand revealed. Unluckily, this study has its dangers, its drawbacks of several kinds. It is difficult to adopt a point of view which will enable one to judge one's fellow creatures fairly. It is one of the chief defects of history to paint men's evil deeds rather than their good ones. It is revolutions and catastrophes that make history interesting. So long as a nation grows and prospers quietly in the tranquility of a peaceful government, history says nothing. She only begins to speak of nations when, no longer able to be self-sufficing, they interfere with their neighbor's business, or allow their neighbors to interfere with their own. History only makes them famous when they are on the downward path. All our histories begin where they ought to end. We have very accurate accounts of declining nations. What we lack is the history of those nations which are multiplying. They are so happy and so good that history has nothing to tell us of them, and we see indeed in our own times that the most successful governments are least talked of. We only hear what is bad, the good is scarcely mentioned. Only the wicked become famous, the good are forgotten or laughed to scorn, and thus history, like philosophy, is forever slandering mankind. Moreover, it is inevitable that the facts described in history should not give an exact picture of what really happened, they are transformed in the brain of the historian, they are molded by his interests and colored by his prejudices. Who can place the reader precisely in a position to see the event as it really happened? Ignorance or partiality disguises everything. What a different impression may be given merely by expanding or contracting the circumstances of the case without altering a single historical incident. The same object may be seen from several points of view, and it will hardly seem the same thing, yet there has been no change except in the eye that beholds it. Do you indeed do honor to truth when what you tell me is a genuine fact, but you make it appear something quite different? A tree more or less, a rock to the right or to the left, a cloud of dust raised by the wind, how often have these decided the result of a battle without anyone knowing it? Does that prevent history from telling you the cause of defeat or victory with as much assurance as if she had been on the spot? But what are the facts to me, while I am ignorant of their causes? And what lessons can I draw from an event, whose true cause is unknown to me? The historian indeed gives me a reason, but he invents it. And criticism itself, of which we hear so much, is only the art of guessing, the art of choosing from among several lies, the lie that is most like truth. Have you ever read Cleopatra or Cassandra or any books of the kind? The author selects some well-known event, he then adapts it to his purpose, adorns it with details of his own invention, with people who never existed, with imaginary portraits, thus he piles fiction on fiction to lend a charm to his story. I see little difference between such romances and your histories, unless it is that the novelist draws more on his own imagination, while the historian slavishly copies what another has imagined. I will also admit, if you please, that the novelist has some moral purpose, good or bad, about which the historian scarcely concerns himself. You will tell me that accuracy in history is of less interest than a true picture of men and manners. Provided the human heart is truly portrayed, it matters little that events should be accurately recorded. For after all you say, what does it matter to us what happened 2,000 years ago? You are right if the portraits are indeed truly given according to nature. But if the model is to be found for the most part in the historian's imagination, are you not falling into the very error you intended to avoid? And surrendering to the authority of the historian what you would not yield to the authority of the teacher? If my pupil is merely to see fancy pictures, I would rather draw them myself. They will, at least, be better suited to him. The worst historians for a youth are those who give their opinions. Facts. Facts. And let him decide for himself, this is how he will learn to know mankind. If he is always directed by the opinion of the author, he is only seeing through the eyes of another person, and when those eyes are no longer at his disposal, he can see nothing. I leave modern history on one side, not only because it has no character and all our people are alike, but because our historians, wholly taken up with effect, think of nothing but highly colored portraits, which often represent nothing. The old historians generally give fewer portraits and bring more intelligence and common sense to their judgments, but even among them there is plenty of scope for choice, and you must not begin with the wisest but with the simplest. I would not put Polybius or Sallust into the hands of a youth. Tacitus is the author of the old, young men cannot understand him. You must learn to see in human actions the simplest features of the heart of man before you try to sound its depths. You must be able to read facts clearly before you begin to study maxims. Philosophy in the form of maxims is only fit for the experienced. Youth should never deal with the general, all its teaching should deal with individual instances. To my mind, Thucydides is the true model of historians. He relates facts without giving his opinion, but he omits no circumstance adapted to make us judge for ourselves. He puts everything that he relates before his reader, far from interposing between the facts and the readers, he conceals himself, we seem not to read but to see. Unfortunately, he speaks of nothing but war, and in his stories we only see the least instructive part of the world, that is to say the battles. The virtues and defects of the retreat of the 10,000 and the commentaries of Caesar are almost the same. The kindly Herodotus, without portraits, without maxims, yet flowing, simple, full of details calculated to delight and interest in the highest degree, would be perhaps the best historian if these very details did not often degenerate into childish folly, better adapted to spoil the taste of youth than to form it. We need discretion before we can read him. I say nothing of Livy, his turn will come, but he is a statesman, a rhetorician, he is everything which is unsuitable for a youth. History in general is lacking because it only takes note of striking and clearly marked facts which may be fixed by names, places, and dates, but the slow evolution of these facts, which cannot be definitely noted in this way, still remains unknown. We often find in some battle, lost or won, the ostensible cause of a revolution which was inevitable before this battle took place. War only makes manifest events already determined by moral causes, which few historians can perceive. The philosophic spirit has turned the thoughts of many of the historians of our times in this direction, but I doubt whether truth has profited by their labors. The rage for systems has got possession of all alike. No one seeks to see things as they are, but only as they agree with his system. Add to all these considerations the fact that history shows us actions rather than men, because she only seizes men at certain chosen times in full dress, she only portrays the statesman when he is prepared to be seen, she does not follow him to his home, to his study, among his family and his friends, she only shows him in state, it is his clothes rather than himself that she describes. I would prefer to begin the study of the human heart with reading the lives of individuals, for then the man hides himself in vain, the historian follows him everywhere, he never gives him a moment's grace nor any corner where he can escape the piercing eye of the spectator, and when he thinks he is concealing himself, then it is that the writer shows him up most plainly. Those who write lives, says Montaigne, in so far as they delight more in ideas than in events, more in that which comes from within than in that which comes from without, these are the writers I prefer, for this reason Plutarch is in every way the man for me. It is true that the genius of men in groups or nations is very different from the character of the individual man, and that we have a very imperfect knowledge of the human heart if we do not also examine it in crowds, but it is nonetheless true that to judge of men we must study the individual man, and that he who had a perfect knowledge of the inclinations of each individual might foresee all their combined effects in the body of the nation. We must go back again to the ancients, for the reasons already stated, and also because all the details common and familiar, but true and characteristic, are banished by modern stylists, so that men are as much tricked out by our modern authors in their private life as in public. Propriety, no less strict in literature than in life, no longer permits us to say anything in public which we might not do in public, and as we may only show the man dressed up for his part, we never see a man in our books any more than we do on the stage. The lives of kings may be written 100 times, but to no purpose, we shall never have another Suetonius. The excellence of Plutarch consists in these very details which we are no longer permitted to describe. With inimitable grace he paints the great man in little things, and he is so happy in the choice of his instances that a word, a smile, a gesture, will often suffice to indicate the nature of his hero. With a jest Hannibal cheers his frightened soldiers, and leads them laughing to the battle which will lay Italy at his feet, Agesilaus riding on a stick makes me love the conqueror of the great king, Caesar passing through a poor village and chatting with his friends unconsciously betrays the traitor who professed that he only wished to be Pompey's equal. Alexander swallows a draft without a word, it is the finest moment in his life, Aristides writes his own name on the shell and so justifies his title, Philopemen, his mantle laid aside, chops firewood in the kitchen of his host. This is the true art of portraiture. Our disposition does not show itself in our features, nor our character in our great deeds, it is trifles that show what we really are. What is done in public is either too commonplace or too artificial, and our modern authors are almost too grand to tell us anything else. M. de Turin was undoubtedly one of the greatest men of the last century. They have had the courage to make his life interesting by the little details which make us know and love him, but how many details have they felt obliged to omit which might have made us know and love him better still? I will only quote one which I have on good authority, one which Plutarch would never have omitted, and one which Ramsay would never have inserted had he been acquainted with it. On a hot summer's day, Viscount Turin in a little white vest and nightcap was standing at the window of his antechamber. One of his men came up and, misled by the dress, took him for one of the kitchen lads whom he knew. He crept up behind him and smacked him with no light hand. The man he struck turned round hastily. The valet saw it was his master and trembled at the sight of his face. He fell on his knees in desperation. "Sir, I thought it was George." "Well, even if it was George," exclaimed Turin, rubbing the injured part, "you need not have struck so hard. You do not dare to say this, you miserable writers. Remain forever without humanity and without feeling, steel your hard hearts in your vile propriety, make yourselves contemptible through your high mightiness. But as for you, dear youth, when you read this anecdote, when you are touched by all the kindliness displayed even on the impulse of the moment, read also the littleness of this great man when it was a question of his name and birth. Remember it was this very Turin who always professed to yield precedence to his nephew, so that all men might see that this child was the head of a royal house. Look on this picture and on that, love nature, despise popular prejudice, and know the man as he was. There are few people able to realize what an effect such reading, carefully directed, will have upon the unspoilt mind of a youth. Weighed down by books from our earliest childhood, accustomed to read without thinking, what we read strikes us even less, because we already bear in ourselves the passions and prejudices with which history and the lives of men are filled. All that they do strikes us as only natural, for we ourselves are unnatural and we judge others by ourselves. But imagine my Emile, who has been carefully guarded for 18 years with the sole object of preserving a right judgment and a healthy heart, imagine him when the curtain goes up casting his eyes for the first time upon the world's stage, or rather picture him behind the scenes watching the actors don their costumes, and counting the cords and pulleys which deceive with their feigned shows the eyes of the spectators. His first surprise will soon give place to feelings of shame and scorn of his fellow man. He will be indignant at the sight of the whole human race deceiving itself and stooping to this childish folly. He will grieve to see his brothers tearing each other limb from limb for a mere dream, and transforming themselves into wild beasts because they could not be content to be men. Given the natural disposition of the pupil, there is no doubt that if the master exercises any sort of prudence or discretion in his choice of reading, however little he may put him in the way of reflecting on the subject matter, this exercise will serve as a course in practical philosophy, a philosophy better understood and more thoroughly mastered than all the empty speculations with which the brains of lads are muddled in our schools. After following the romantic schemes of Pyrrhus, Cineas asks him what real good he would gain by the conquest of the world, which he can never enjoy without such great sufferings. This only arouses in us a passing interest as a smart saying, but Emile will think it a very wise thought, one which had already occurred to himself, and one which he will never forget, because there is no hostile prejudice in his mind to prevent it sinking in. When he reads more of the life of this madman, he will find that all his great plans resulted in his death at the hands of a woman. And instead of admiring this pinchbeck heroism, what will he see in the exploits of this great captain and the schemes of this great statesman but so many steps towards that unlucky tile which was to bring life and schemes alike to a shameful death? All conquerors have not been killed. All usurpers have not failed in their plans. To minds imbued with vulgar prejudices, many of them will seem happy, but he who looks below the surface and reckons men's happiness by the condition of their hearts will perceive their wretchedness even in the midst of their successes. He will see them panting after advancement and never attaining their prize. He will find them like those inexperienced travelers among the Alps, who think that every height they see is the last, who reach its summit only to find to their disappointment there are loftier peaks beyond. Augustus, when he had subdued his fellow citizens and destroyed his rivals, reigned for 40 years over the greatest empire that ever existed, but all this vast power could not hinder him from beating his head against the walls, and filling his palace with his groans as he cried to Varus to restore his slaughtered legions. If he had conquered all his foes, what good would his empty triumphs have done him, when troubles of every kind beset his path, when his life was threatened by his dearest friends, and when he had to mourn the disgrace or death of all near and dear to him? The wretched man desired to rule the world and failed to rule his own household. What was the result of this neglect? He beheld his nephew, his adopted child, his son-in-law, perish in the flower of youth, his grandson reduced to eat the stuffing of his mattress to prolong his wretched existence for a few hours, his daughter and his granddaughter, after they had covered him with infamy, died, the one of hunger and want on a desert island, the other imprisoned by the hand of a common archer. He himself, the last survivor of his unhappy house, found himself compelled by his own wife to acknowledge a monster as his heir. Such was the fate of the master of the world, so famous for his glory and his good fortune. I cannot believe that any one of those who admire his glory and fortune would accept them at the same price. I have taken ambition as my example, but the play of every human passion offers similar lessons to any one who will study history to make himself wise and good at the expense of those who went before. The time is drawing near when the teaching of the life of Anthony will appeal more forcibly to the youth than the life of Augustus. Emile will scarcely know where he is among the many strange sights in his new studies, but he will know beforehand how to avoid the illusion of passions before they arise, and seeing how in all ages they have blinded men's eyes, he will be forewarned of the way in which they may one day blind his own should he abandon himself to them. These lessons, I know, are unsuited to him, perhaps at need they may prove scanty and ill-timed, but remember they are not the lessons I wish to draw from this study. To begin with, I had quite another end in view, and indeed, if this purpose is unfulfilled, the teacher will be to blame. Remember that, as soon as selfishness has developed, the self in its relations to others is always with us, and the youth never observes others without coming back to himself and comparing himself with them. From the way young men are taught to study history, I see that they are transformed, so to speak, into the people they behold, that you strive to make a Cicero, a Trajan, or an Alexander of them, to discourage them when they are themselves again, to make everyone regret that he is merely himself. There are certain advantages in this plan which I do not deny, but, so far as Emile is concerned, should it happen at any time when he is making these comparisons that he wishes to be anyone but himself, were it Socrates or Cato, I have failed entirely. He who begins to regard himself as a stranger will soon forget himself altogether. It is not philosophers who know most about men, they only view them through the preconceived ideas of philosophy, and I know no one so prejudiced as philosophers. A savage would judge us more sanely. The philosopher is aware of his own vices, he is indignant at ours, and he says to himself, "We are all bad alike." The savage beholds us unmoved and says, "You are mad." He is right, for no one does evil for evil's sake. My pupil is that savage, with this difference, Emile has thought more, he has compared ideas, seen our errors at close quarters, he is more on his guard against himself, and only judges of what he knows. It is our own passions that excite us against the passions of others, it is our self-interest which makes us hate the wicked, if they did us no harm we should pity rather than hate them. We should readily forgive their vices if we could perceive how their own heart punishes those vices. We are aware of the offense, but we do not see the punishment, the advantages are plain, the penalty is hidden. The man who thinks he is enjoying the fruits of his vices is no less tormented by them than if they had not been successful, the object is different, the anxiety is the same, in vain he displays his good fortune and hides his heart, in spite of himself his conduct betrays him, but to discern this, our own heart must be utterly unlike his. We are led astray by those passions which we share, we are disgusted by those that militate against our own interests, and with a want of logic due to these very passions, we blame in others what we fain would imitate. Aversion and self-deception are inevitable when we are forced to endure at another's hands what we ourselves would do in his place. What then is required for the proper study of men? A great wish to know men, great impartiality of judgment, a heart sufficiently sensitive to understand every human passion, and calm enough to be free from passion. If there is any time in our life when this study is likely to be appreciated, it is this that I have chosen for Emile. Before this time men would have been strangers to him, later on he would have been like them. Convention, the effects of which he already perceives, has not yet made him its slave, the passions, whose consequences he realizes, have not yet stirred his heart. He is a man. He takes an interest in his brethren, he is a just man and he judges his peers. Now it is certain that if he judges them rightly he will not want to change places with any one of them, for the goal of all their anxious efforts is the result of prejudices which he does not share, and that goal seems to him a mere dream. For his own part, he has all he wants within his reach. How should he be dependent on any one when he is self-sufficing and free from prejudice? Strong arms, good health, moderation, few needs, together with the means to satisfy those needs, are his. He has been brought up in complete liberty and servitude is the greatest ill he understands. He pities these miserable kings, the slaves of all who obey them, he pities these false prophets fettered by their empty fame, he pities these rich fools, martyrs to their own pomp, he pities these ostentatious voluptuaries, who spend their life in deadly dullness that they may seem to enjoy its pleasures. He would pity the very foe who harmed him, for he would discern his wretchedness beneath his cloak of spite. He would say to himself, "This man has yielded to his desire to hurt me, and this need of his places him at my mercy." One step more and our goal is attained. Selfishness is a dangerous tool, though a useful one. It often wounds the hand that uses it, and it rarely does good unmixed with evil. When Emile considers his place among men, when he finds himself so fortunately situated, he will be tempted to give credit to his own reason for the work of yours, and to attribute to his own deserts what is really the result of his good fortune. He will say to himself, "I am wise and other men are fools." He will pity and despise them and will congratulate himself all the more heartily, and as he knows he is happier than they, he will think his deserts are greater. This is the fault we have most to fear, for it is the most difficult to eradicate. If he remained in this state of mind, he would have profited little by all our care, and if I had to choose, I hardly know whether I would not rather choose the illusions of prejudice than those of pride. Great men are under no illusion with respect to their superiority. They see it and know it, but they are none the less modest. The more they have, the better they know what they lack. They are less vain of their superiority over us than ashamed by the consciousness of their weakness, and among the good things they really possess, they are too wise to pride themselves on a gift which is none of their getting. The good man may be proud of his virtue, for it is his own, but what cause for pride has the man of intellect? What has Racine done that he is not preyed on, and Boileau that he is not Cotin? The circumstances with which we are concerned are quite different. Let us keep to the common level. I assumed that my pupil had neither surpassing genius nor a defective understanding. I chose him of an ordinary mind to show what education could do for man. Exceptions defy all rules. If, therefore, as a result of my care, Emile prefers his way of living, seeing, and feeling to that of others, he is right. But if he thinks because of this that he is nobler and better born than they, he is wrong, he is deceiving himself, he must be undeceived, or rather let us prevent the mistake, lest it be too late to correct it. Provided a man is not mad, he can be cured of any folly but vanity. There is no cure for this but experience, if indeed there is any cure for it at all. When it first appears we can at least prevent its further growth. But do not on this account waste your breath on empty arguments to prove to the youth that he is like other men and subject to the same weaknesses. Make him feel it or he will never know it.